Welcome to the Together in the UK podcast. Today I'm interviewing Sadiqa Esmail, a British Indian, an actor, and a Muslim. When we first spoke, Sadiqa told me that she loved debate and that when we embrace diversity, we do not know what we will learn, but the possibilities for learning are endless. I think it came from the top of her head, but I thought it was such a great insight, I tweeted it. I'm delighted to be having this conversation this evening and looking forward to some debates and to some learning. So first of all, Sadiqa, you've just finished Ramadan and celebrated Eid. How was Ramadan and Eid for you?
Hi, Teresa. Nice to be speaking with you. I'm looking forward to this conversation as well and debates and some learning. And yeah, we've just finished Ramadan and we had Eid on Thursday of last week. I think it was a perfect time to have a month of reflection, spirituality, growth, because, you know, the pandemic has really drained us. So it gave us the opportunity to really get in touch with ourselves and embrace the religion and, you know, just have a detox as well in all kind of senses. So it's been a fantastic month. We've had a feast, which is really good. And now there's, you know, it looks like there's light at the end of the tunnel. The lockdown is, and now we're a little bit more freer. We have a little bit more life to live. So it's all looking really, really good.
Oh, that's great. I imagine if I ever was doing something like Ramadan, I would spend a lot of time thinking about the feast at the end. Does that happen, or actually you manage to stay in that spiritual space?
I think everybody does panic beforehand because it's a very intense period, you know, and I think we all start focusing on, oh, how much food can we get in before the month and what's going to happen and let's just wait and think about the month at the end. And I think it really takes only about 3 or 4 fasts before you form a discipline. And it really is about disrupting your whole of your discipline so that you can start from scratch and you can begin from where, you know, like as though you're starting a new life even. So I think after about 4 or 5 days, you forget about the feast and you start to have a new discipline. And the new discipline varies for everybody, you know. It might mean that you have smaller food or you have better food or you decide to go vegetarian or vegan or whatever it is that you want to do. But it's just starting afresh. And I think you forget and you kind of get over the initial panic of, oh my God, you know, the food, and you tend to forget. But then when you approach the end, then you start looking, then you start thinking about, oh my God, I'm going to have so much food. It's going to be really nice. But you also start missing the month already because you realize how much you've grown in that month, you know, because it's not only about giving up food. It's about, you know, forming a discipline in your personality, in your growth, in the way you deliver yourself to people, your relationship with God, and, you know, keeping away from what you might not think is bad for you, but it is. So there's lots of things that actually happen in the space of that month. And I think by the end, we just start missing it. But then we do have our eyes on the feast too.
Thank you. Well, I've already learned a lot. And particularly, I was really interested in you connecting the renewal of Ramadan with actually coming out of lockdown and the sense of perhaps hope that we all have now. I think lockdown for me has made me really appreciate ordinary things. So being able to chat to a friend face to face. Maybe we've all had to give up things.
Yeah.
And maybe we can connect with actually what Ramadan does, because you just appreciate the smaller things that you haven't been able to have over the last year.
Yes.
So I'm going to move on a little bit, because our theme for Together in the UK is understanding migration. It's both from first and second generation perspectives. So I'd love to know what you think the two cultures of British and Indian give you.
So, yes, I am British and I am Indian as well. And just before what they give me, I feel like I need to highlight 2 really important things that stick out for me when it comes to different cultures. And it's the pressure from the culture and the question of belonging. And what I mean by that is, like most of the parents who migrate or move to the UK, you know, they do it for better life, better opportunities, and, you know, to make something different out of themselves that they probably couldn't do in their own home country. Now, they make a sacrifice because they do leave their countries behind and then they migrate. So we, as the second generation immigrants, I think recognize that sacrifice that they made. So we find ourselves in like a space where we're continually trying to prove ourselves, you know, and to fulfill that sacrifice that they made, not just to them, but to the society as a whole, because it becomes, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a battle, but it becomes the thing that you have to do. And the other thing is I feel like you get caught between the cultures sometimes, and, you know, it can make you feel a little bit unstable because at times you don't know where you belong. But then having said that, it's not negative, it's actually positive, because when you combine those two factors together, you end up creating this thriving attitude to combine these different cultures together and making it unique, you know, making it your own. And you get the chance to really take on the mixed cultures, and you become curious and you explore the options, and you actually get the opportunity to pick the best of both cultures. I think that's quite exciting, and I think it gives you the chance to really trial, test, you know, what you like from both things, and then choose the best and make it your own. So in effect, you get the chance to be unique, you know, and I think that's quite positive from both of the cultures.
The pressure to excel because of the sacrifices your parents have made is very interesting. I've seen debate around the sort of migrant as hero narrative and people not liking that.
Yeah.
And thinking, actually, it's okay to be ordinary and to just, you don't have to be a hero. So it's sort of interesting to hear you kind of feeling this pressure, and also that you see it as a position of choice.
Yes.
And it takes, I think, some reflection and sort of going inside to actually see that you have choice. There's a poem that I like, which has this line, ancestral voices bind us. So I think to understand that you have choice takes some doing.
I think so. I do agree. I mean, I think you have to experience some stages in life and maybe have some bad experiences as well as good experiences. And then you start to learn that, you know, it's, I don't have to do this, or I can do this, or I want to do this. And then you find yourself in a position that when you're not feeling the pressure, you excel better and you excel naturally. And when you excel naturally, you tend to embrace everything about you. So it is a case of, I think, living life. And then after some time, you come to a space where you can, you know, you do understand that it's choice. It is a choice of what you want to take from which culture, how much you want to take of it, and whether you want to embrace it or not. That's your choice. But I think initially what happens is, I think society makes you believe that you have to shine all the time. You have to shine to prove yourself. And I think that's a very indirect pressure from everyone, not just the parents, but just like from everybody, even those that are not immigrants. And that is something that I think you only overcome through experiences and time, I would say.
Yes, yes. There is this thing about when you let it go,
yes,
things flow better. And that intensity of feeling that you've got to excel can be hard. And I think what I understood, you were saying that although we might all feel that pressure, there's an extra pressure if your parents have made a big sacrifice to give you a better life.
I think so. I think so. And though they don't mean it, though they don't impose it on you, I think you naturally feel that pressure. I don't think they intend to impose it on you, because it's not something they say to you. It's more that you realize that they left their country so that you could have a better life, you know, and you recognize that gap and you see them miss their home because that's their first home. So when you see that, I think it's an indirect pressure to fulfill that sacrifice that they made for you. So it's not really negative. It's more that you understand what they gave up, and I think you end up wanting to, you know, give them something back. I think it's a way of giving, but it's, you know, it does sometimes feel like pressure, I would say.
I understand that. I wondered if you've had times when you felt very British and times you felt very Indian, or whether you've kind of feel that you synthesize. You know, you told me you've felt choice, but have there, any examples you could share?
Yeah, I mean, if I be very specific, I think when it comes to etiquette, that's when I feel very British or very much Indian. And that's what I mean by that is because, you know, society and culture conforms you. It pushes you to behave in a certain way. So, you know, if we just take British and Indian cultures as an example, the etiquette behind the way you eat, the way you dress, the way you hold yourself, and, you know, the way you make and maintain relationships, those are things for me that I feel very either British or very Indian. So when I'm eating very traditional food, I feel very, very Indian. But then when I'm in a restaurant, you know, with other people, I feel very British because I feel like we have to follow, you know, the etiquette, the way you eat. You know, you have your fork in your left hand, you have your knife in your right hand, and those are not the same rules that we would have as an Indian. So I think depending on how you're living your life, it's very, very specific. The etiquette behind the way you hold yourself, the way you treat elders or your parents, it's very different in an Indian culture and it's very different in a British culture. And, 'cause I know that in an Indian culture, parents, we have them as a very high status. And it's very nice, it's very loving, and it's very respectful. And though it's also there in the British culture, it's not there in the same way. So I really know when I'm British and I really know when I'm Indian. But just while I'm speaking with you, there's an example that's come to me. And this is something that happens quite often. So you know how you have the equal opportunities form that you fill in when you apply for a job or when you apply for something? There's always those boxes that says, oh, you're white, you know, tick if you're white British, or whether you're Asian British, whether you're, you know, whatever options there are. And whenever I fill that form in, me personally, what happens is I feel like there's a vibe around if you consider yourself to be British, you need to be white British, as in you'd never feel wholly British unless you're white British. And then what sometimes happens is you feel pressured to being British because you're forced to pick a box. And then at those times, I feel very Indian because I feel like I don't feel pressured for being Indian. In fact, it's quite liberating. And I feel rich from that culture and I feel like I belong to a heritage. And, you know, it somewhat grounds me. And it makes me feel really sort of, you know, I really know who I am. So when it comes to ticking boxes, it makes me feel uncomfortable because I feel like the boxes don't make you feel British. So I think it comes down to how you perceive both of the cultures.
Yeah. And I know there's a lot of thinking around that now and thinking you must have an option that says British Indian.
Yes. Yes. However, having said that, those forms are also a way of providing equal opportunities. So there's also a plus side to that. That's just a feeling and maybe an example to demonstrate what happens or a thought process even.
Yeah. Oh, they definitely are meant to provide evidence to see if we can make the world fairer.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on. I know you were a hijab.
Yes.
When we chatted, I mentioned an essay in The Good Immigrant, which can discuss how going through an airport for ethnic minorities can almost be like going through an audition. There's a famous actor who describes you don't know if you'll go through to the next stage. And I wondered if you had had any encounters like that.
That's a really good story because the airport analogy is a really good way to explain how auditions feel like. It's very much like an airport journey, you know, the steps through getting to your final destination. So yes, I had one Well, I had many encounters, but I'm just going to give you one in this episode. And it's the time when I decided to go and travel out to New York. And I traveled from London to Frankfurt. And then the connecting flight from Frankfurt was to New York. And all was okay here in London. Everything was fine, you know, and it felt like it's all going to go smoothly. So you would normally just have your normal checks and get through the security. But what I found was when I got to the security point, it's come to a point as a hijabi, it feels like it's very much normalized for a hijab wearing person to have an extra check. I don't know why that is. I don't know why that's happened, but we almost normalize it. So when you go, when you're taken separately away somewhere, it feels like it's a normal thing to happen. But really, that should never be normalized. However, it does happen and it has happened. And they kind of go with that kind of flow. But what happens in an airport journey is every time you get stopped, you never know if you're going to move on to the next stage. So when I was in London, I was fine. I took a flight. I got to Frankfurt. But when I got to Frankfurt and I needed to check in to take the next flight, they kept repeating my name. And by repeating my name, it got to a point where it felt intimidating. You know, it felt intimidating to me that what are they going to do? What is it with my name? Is there a history behind my name? Is there something that they tag behind my name? And that also happens in auditions, because sometimes you'll go there and before they've even seen you, just by repeating your name, you feel intimidated because you think that they've already made a judgment based on your name. And that happens at the airport. And then the next thing that happened to me from there, I did get onto through the check-in counter at Frankfurt, and then I was at the security line. And while I was at the security line, I was waiting, and the security guard took me out from the middle of that line and he took me straight to the front. So I did feel like a VIP. However, he was questioning me. He was taking me through some security checks, and it was quite confronting because it was, you know, in front of a lot of people. But I didn't know what was going to happen next. I don't know why. I didn't know whether he was going to extract me and say, you can't travel anymore, or whether he was going to extract me and say, right, go straight through. He did send me straight through, but only to find that I went to a private cabin where they did like a body check, which was quite extensive. Again, you know, they treated me like as if I was somebody special. However, it wasn't very positive because I kept getting removed as a person just because I was wearing a hijab. And again, this happens in auditions, you know. Sometimes you'll be there in an open audition and they'll just extract you and you don't know why you've been extracted. You don't know whether you've been extracted because of your name or how you look. And you don't know whether you're going to make it through the rest of it or whether you're going to be pushed forward and say you're actually the talent that, you know, we're looking for. But anyway, I did get on the flight. I got to New York. The flight was fine. And then it was going through the security to exit from the airport out into New York. So I was there again. They did some more checks. They asked me a lot of questions. I still didn't know what was going to happen. And this, again, happens in auditions. You can go through so many steps and you reach the very final part and you still don't know what's happening. And what it is that they do is they speak to you, but they never give you a reason as to why you were either good enough or not good enough, or whether they liked you or they didn't like you. And a lot of the times it's not very personal that they put this on you. It's more that it's a procedure that they carry out. And this happens both in flights, you know, traveling journeys, as well as auditions. So I think it's a really good analogy to use. So I did make it to New York and I enjoyed myself, which is fantastic. So that was a great outcome at the end. But yeah, it is. You just never know what's going to happen. And you just never know when you're chosen, whether it's for a good thing or a bad thing. So whether you're going to make it to your final destination or not.
It sounds so bewildering and stressful.
Yeah.
But of course, in acting, the rewards might be huge. But it's somebody who not only does Together in the UK, but also works in diversity. I think there's something so important in what you've said around making people, being very clear what the processes are.
Yes.
because if they're not, then it's confusing and stressful.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the meaning of the hijab. What is its meaning to you?
Okay, so hijab itself obviously comes from Islam, you know, being a Muslim. And it's actually an obligation, as in every Muslim woman should wear the hijab. It's as in it's a ruling, you know, it's part of the religion. And hijab for me, you know, it's part of my identity. And it shows who I am and what my beliefs are. It doesn't define me, you know, but it does show you that I'm committed to something, and almost like a symbol where people can recognize that, you know, she's a Muslim person and she's got her hijab. So for me, it's a choice, you know, that I've made because I feel very committed to my religion. I don't feel as though it takes anything away from me. In fact, I feel that it is quite empowering because it's my choice that I've done this, you know, and I've done this thing for myself. And it gives me a ground to stand on. And I like that ground, you know. It makes me feel powerful as well. And it's a relationship that I have with God. You know, and that relationship is evident because my hijab shows that I have a relationship with God and I believe in him and I am doing it as a sacrifice. It is a sacrifice, but it's also empowering because the beliefs around a hijab, you know, are very rewarding. And that reward is like almost like a motivation to strive through life because you know that you're doing something that is perfect for you in your religion. However, although I say that it's an obligation for women to wear hijab in Islam, it doesn't give me the right to judge any other woman who doesn't wear a hijab because it doesn't make her a non-Muslim. You know, I have to emphasize that because sometimes people think that, oh, yeah, it's a choice. Of course it's a choice. It's a choice because you commit to that choice. But in terms of religion, it's an obligation for women to take that. And some women maybe don't reach that point or something like that. But for me, I consider it to be that I'm quite fortunate that I discovered the hijab and I committed to it. And it's very inspirational for me. And there's a lot of life that I have to live yet through wearing the hijab.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was really inspiring and interesting. And I was reminded of a podcast I listened to. Somebody was interviewing somebody who is an Orthodox Jew, and they said that underneath the restrictions, there's a lot of freedom. And it kind of, that's what I was hearing in you saying it is a sacrifice, but it's something that enables.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just a piece of cloth, you see, because sometimes people see this garment, this hijab, as just a cloth that covers your hair, but it's not like that. It's like, you know, you can say, what's a book cover? You know, you might look at the book cover and you might make a judgment on the book cover and you might start having feelings and emotions towards this book cover. But in reality, the content is in the pages. The pages have a lot for you to connect with. And by the time you get to the end of the book, you know, you've really learned something and you've gone through a journey. And that you can see is just like a hijab. What you're seeing when you're seeing is the front cover, but beneath it, there's so much there. And, you know, the more the time passes, the more your hijab for you as a person enriches, you know, and it deepens because it starts meaning more and more. And the more challenges you have with your hijab, this is a very personal perspective, but I feel like the more challenges that I have, the more committed I feel to it because it's almost like you develop like a rebellious behavior if somebody contests against your hijab because you think, hang on, this is my hijab. Please don't detest it because it doesn't harm you. It's something that makes me grow. You know, it's for me and I enjoy this and I like this and I want to wear it. So, yeah, so for me, it's very huge. It's very, very big.
Yeah, very important. We're going to move on now. We've talked a lot about your faith, cultural identity. And I think people listening to this would love to know about, say, you've recently graduated from drama school and I've... having dabbled a little bit in evening classes on introduction to acting. I know that acting gives you so much. So what do you think studying acting gave you?
So firstly, acting is actually, for me, my second career. First I studied computer science and I worked in the world of tech. And then, I grew in that world and I enjoyed it. But then I came to a point in my life where I wanted to do something creative. I didn't know what it meant, but somehow I landed into acting. And as I landed into acting, it did everything for me. It opened my eyes. It allowed me to explore a world that I didn't even think I would enter, and I found myself in a world where I could look at people from a different perspective. And all I wanted to do by the end of drama school is tell stories and tell stories from, people who interest me and have never been able to see their lives or understand their lives or I've wanted to. And, it's for me, it's about understanding who people are and telling a story from their eyes. It's done absolutely everything for me. And the technique that I trained in is called Meisner. And what it does, it focuses on you connecting to your emotional instrument and reacting instinctively, truthfully in your surrounding environment. And it comes down to living truthfully under imaginary circumstances, So you do extract yourself from the real world and put yourself into this imaginary world. And I think it's absolutely fantastic. It did everything for me. And also, one of the best things that I learned through acting is not being judgmental. I mean, I do consider myself, I don't consider myself to be a judgmental person, but we all have some form of judgment in us just naturally. But when you train to be an actor, I think you lose that too, because if you want to wear somebody else's body and if you want to play a character, you have to drop your judgments. And I think that's a really beautiful journey, because even if something clashes with your principles or your ethos or the way you choose to live, when you study acting, you get to a point where you can't judge anybody because you start seeing the beauty behind who they are. And I think that's the biggest thing for me. And I can only see that as art, which is quite ironic, because being an actor, you end up being non-judgmental, but then the industry itself is extremely judgmental. So it's a bit of a clash there, but acting has done so much for me. It's opened a whole new world.
Yeah, I see that. And I'm just going to pick up on the technique, because I remember being told when I was doing my evening classes, don't act, don't put it on.
Yes.
So I see you connecting to the emotional truth means you're not acting.
Yeah.
You are inhabiting.
Yes.
Now, I know you've made some podcasts designed to inspire people.
Yes.
Have you sort of got some life lessons from exploring that?
Not exactly. What it is when I graduated, the moment I graduated, we literally got into the pandemic. So it was very unfortunate. Of course, it was unfortunate for everybody, but just in the place that I was, I graduated and then the film industry completely crashed, like many other industries. And it put me in a position where we couldn't act. We trained to be actors, but we couldn't act because we weren't allowed to. The theatres went down. Even the theatres are just about getting themselves together now. The filming, they had to completely reconstruct the way they did things. So we didn't have them options. So in that time, what I decided to do is launch a series of Instagram Lives. And they were with creative people, different, from different backgrounds. Like we had comedians, singers, actors, songwriters, journalists even, there was quite a lot of people, because I collaborated with a network called Emerald Network, and they had access to a lot of people who follow them. So I approached them, and what the whole idea behind these Instagram Lives was to, to understand that other creatives, everybody, I think, some people say, I'm not creative. I think everybody is creative, because creative doesn't have to mean you're saying dance or draw or write. It can mean anything. It just means you find a different way of doing things, you know, and you'll probably find that you are creative somehow and you haven't discovered it yet. So these people that I had the Instagram lives with, you know, they gave us an insight into how they do things, what they've achieved, but they also highlighted the fact that we too have battles, you know, we have issues, we have to overcome these issues. Because when you see things on social media, it's quite deceiving, you know, you just see the pretty picture, but you don't see the battle behind the pretty picture. And the idea behind that was, it's create, you know, enjoy, be inspired, do something you want to do. And even if you don't know what you want to do, just go out there and explore and do the things. And the acting for me in that was, is to be really truthful, you know, with my guest. And this is something really interesting that I discovered through the Instagram lives. But what I was doing was, every time I met a person, obviously I treated them with respect and had a fantastic conversation with them. But at the same time, they became a character for me. So when I met the first person, I would have conversation, I would understand them, and then I would understand who they are and almost embrace them and keep them as a character and then put them in my library. So you never know, one day when I'm working on a character or a role and something comes up, I may remember this person. Oh yeah, I met this person, this is how they behaved, this is how they spoke, this is what they thought about the world, etc. And those things are really important when you come down to building character as an actor, because the more people you meet, the more you see, the more choices you have to put into your character. So as well as the viewers having a great time, I had an incredible experience by doing those Instagram lives.
And I know that you write. So do you also meet these characters and think, oh, they could be in my writing in some way?
Yeah, I do write. Mostly it's a form of poetry or some kind of a short story. I'm actually giving a shot at writing my own film right now. I don't know how that's going to go. I'm sure it's going to take quite some time, but I am giving that a shot. And I believe that all beautiful things come from dark places or pain. And that's more to do with the circle of life. Like, we go through good times, and then we have bad times and we learn from that. And it's not to project negativity, but it's more to put a spin on the experiences that you've had in these dark times or in these painful times, and give something that, you know, is very relatable to viewers and is beautiful. So most of my inspiration actually comes from real life incidents, whether it's my own or if it's somebody else's or if it's somebody who's close to me or even an absolute stranger, you know, seeing and feeling an experience or having rich conversations is my absolute inspiration. And yeah, that's where a lot of my writing, you know, it really does enrich itself, because somebody's given me something and I see what it is and I add it to the depth of the writing, so to speak.
That's really interesting. And I've often thought that about how suffering can produce really great literature.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the Russian canon is an example of that. And it's interesting that you're saying that even imagining somebody else's pain creates something inside.
Yeah.
Coming to sort of close, and I wonder, if just to sort of round it all off, if you could give us, from your family experience and for your own, a top tip you would give to anyone thinking of migrating to the UK, and perhaps a top tip with somebody who is kind of grappling with some of the issues of being a second generation migrant.
For the benefit of everybody, I think if you're migrating from the UK, I think it's really important for you to be aware of the society, the surroundings, where you're going. But the most important thing I would say is to be open to everybody, with yourself, and to leave like ideologies behind. Because sometimes we hear, there's a lot of hearsay around everywhere. And I don't think you should build your perspective based on hearsay. I think you should be open and you should allow yourself to experience real life and then obviously build your life on those things. So if you're open, then you will come to a place where you will see what the new society is like. And I think it's really important to make the effort to integrate into your place of migration. So obviously bring your home with you from where you come, but also make room for a second home, because that will allow you to integrate well into your new society. And don't judge that society. I think accidentally, we do end up judging a lot of things. We don't mean to do it, but I think we do it. But if we drop these, defenses and drop the judging the situation and being really open to your surroundings and just, you know, live and make your own experience and then come to your own conclusion. I think that, so yeah, bring your own home with you, but please do make room for a second home. That's what I would say. As for people who might be struggling with some of the issues, I think what's important is, as an individual, you know, being the second generation immigrant, I think you probably find yourself in a position where you feel foreign in both of the cultures or however many cultures you have. And what's important is don't feel overwhelmed by where you are, because there's lots of things happening around you. Choose something that suits you. Choose something that makes you happy and embrace it. Don't worry about what people think, because when you start worrying about what people think, or when you start worrying about how you think you're supposed to live, that's when you add the pressure to yourself. And it's not good for you, because you don't actually allow yourself to grow. So I think what you need to do is, again, be open and don't let yourself be overwhelmed by what's happening around you. Instead, put yourself in a position where you can just choose one, two or three things that you like, embrace them, and then start building on that. Because if you start trying tackling everything, I'm sure you're going to, you know, succumb to pressure, you're going to feel overwhelmed, and then you're just going to feel like it's way too much and feel like you don't belong anywhere. But really, you do belong. You do belong, but you're just finding your way, that's all. So give yourself a break and breathe, you know, breathe and just see what's around you.
That sounds really, really great advice. And I'd imagine anybody listening to this would like to watch some of your Insta Lives if they're still recorded. So how should they find them?
You can find me on Instagram, which is at Sadiqa.e. That's Sadiqa.e. Some of my work is on there, not all of it, because I too am very new to the industry, but I'm building myself now, and you know, some exciting things are happening, but you can find me there. So please do connect with me. If you want to collaborate with me, then please do drop a message as well. And let's see what the future brings.
Sadiqa, thank you so much for being such a fascinating guest this evening. And if you want to find out about Together in the UK, go to our website, which is togetherintheuk, all one word, .co.uk. Thank you.
Thank you very much.